From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hold on to your seats, everybody. Big changes are coming to Hollywood, and a lot of Hollywood's movers and shakers are, well, pretty nervous, almost like Brad Pitt's movie family under attack in World War Z, looking for a rescue.
I'm scared.
How do we know they're coming?
They're coming.
Go, go, go. The blockbuster has always been with us, but lately it's almost the only game in town. Why? Because the Hollywood way of doing business is being turned inside out by everything from global markets and money to the end of DVDs and the rise of Netflix. This hour on Point, Hollywood's queasy new chapter. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Are you headed to the movies this summer? Do you want your movie theater to rock to the sound of blazing guns, alien spaceships, and an exploding Capitol building? Hope so, because that's the meat and potatoes of movies this summer. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll look at the way ahead on Hollywood's new path of creative destruction this hour. But first, let's look at what's right in front of us for summer. Ty Burr is with me, author of Gods Like Us on movie stardom and modern fame, film critic for the Boston Globe. Ty, thank you very much for being with us. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So, well, hey, let's bring Tonto in here for just a second. The Lone Ranger's coming. Johnny Depp.
Yes. And this is from the maker and star of the Pirates of the Caribbean series, and it promises more antic Johnny Depp fun. I've seen the movie. I wish I could say it makes good on its promise. To me, the movie kind of represents a lot of what's wrong with big Hollywood summer blockbusters, in that it has an interesting idea and spends a ton of money and really doesn't know what to do with itself to tell a good story.
$250 million almost we're reading. Here's Tonto, played by Johnny Depp, giving life lessons to the Lone Ranger.
There come a time, Kimo Sabe, one good man must wear a mask.
The Lone Ranger back. Ty, how do you figure this got the green light for all that money in a period of global movie audiences? Does the Lone Ranger really have global legs?
You know what? It doesn't even matter what the global audience thinks of the Lone Ranger. All they know is Johnny Depp and the guy who made Pirates of the Caribbean, and those were huge worldwide hits.
True.
So you take a franchise that really has been dormant in the culture. The last Lone Ranger movie was in 1981, and that was a bust. You know, this is just lying around ripe for the picking. So they figure they can turn it into this kind of big summer action extravaganza with a lot of comic trimmings. And, you know, when these things work, which the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie worked very, very well. They work. They're fun. They're fun, and they make a ton of money. This is big, bloated, noisy, with a very dodgy performance by Johnny Depp, you know, that comes really close to Red Face. And Armie Hammer, who's a good actor, doesn't really get much to do as the Lone Ranger. And will it matter? It will probably still make a ton of money in the United States and overseas because their reputation precedes them.
Pacific Rim, another mega budget, hopefully a blockbuster, I guess the studios think, coming out in next week as well. Alien attack threatens the Earth. What's the formula here?
This is like the ultimate summer blockbuster. It's aliens attack, not just from outer space, but from under the depths of the sea. Big, big mammoth aliens. And what does humanity, endangered humanity, do? Well, they build huge, ginormous robots to battle the giant aliens. It's sort of like the ultimate Godzilla movie. Now, it is being directed and comes from Guillermo del Toro, mm-hmm. who's a very, very smart filmmaker of movies Big, the Hellboy movies, and Little, Pan's Labyrinth. He's kind of like the thinking man's Michael Bay. If anybody can make this rock'em sock'em robot thing work, he can, but to the new audience that, you know, the new global audience that Linda Obst is talking about, you know, any sort of wit in there is sort of secondary. They just want to see the robots smash up the aliens.
Well, I mean, say Pacific Rim, and maybe you've got a Chinese audience ready to go.
Absolutely.
I mean, summer is always blockbuster time, but this summer, more than usual. What's driving that, Ty?
What's driving that is It's the new economy of Hollywood, which is you put a lot of your chips on these big, 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 noisy properties that are anchored in, that are familiar. Man of Steel.
Superman.
See, yeah, exactly. I mean, earlier in the year, here's what it looks like now. Earlier in the year, we had a new Die Hard film. Do we need a new Die Hard film? No, but we got one with Bruce Willis, and it took place mostly in Russia with the characters running through Chernobyl and, like, spraying Febreze on the wall so they could walk around without a hazmat suits. And I'm watching this movie thinking, why is this movie taking place all in Russia? And then I realized it's not made for American audiences anymore.
Wow, that's a change. Among the blockbusters, if you were going to pick one or two to actually see, Ty, what would it be?
I have to say, surprisingly, World War Z with Brad Pitt as a heroic UN employee stemming a zombie pandemic, which sounds just absolutely silly on paper, actually works as a movie. It doesn't turn Brad Pitt's character into a, you know, Bruce Willis-y superhero, you know, kind of guy. It makes him relatable, believable, much like Bruce Willis was in the very first Die Hard. And it skips around the globe, and it gives you these big action set pieces, but they're intelligently done. They tell a good story. One thing I like about that movie is that at the very end, every other movie, blockbuster movie these days, has to end with a major city being reduced to rubble for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe that reflects our post 9/11 anxieties, but whatever, it gets boring. World War Z actually ends on a much a smaller note, a kind of a haunted house finale that, for my money, worked really, really well. You know, if you're going to go see one of these kinds of movies, it's actually pretty good.
And what about beyond the blockbusters? What are you watching? What are you recommending?
Well, you know, what's happening in the movie industry now is that we've got this increasing split between these giant behemoths that fill up the multiplexes in 3D and IMAX and just are all about heroes and destruction, and then the smaller mammals running between the dinosaurs' feet. And so you get movies like, well, this summer you get things like Before Midnight, the latest film in the series that Richard Linklater is making with
Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. I loved it. Just terrific.
You get a great little documentary. Remember last summer we had Searching for Sugar Man, this terrific musical documentary. This summer we've got a movie called 20 Feet from Stardom, a history of the great backup singers like Darlene Love and Mary Clayton.
Yep.
And I went and saw it again yesterday with my teenage girls, and everybody came out on air. It's a movie that makes you really, really happy.
Fruitvale Station is coming out next week. This is about the killing of that young man on the subway platform in
Subway
Oakland?
Platform near San Francisco back in 2009. I saw that last week. It's sort of a last day in this kid's life. It's very sad, very affecting, very real. It sounds like something you wouldn't want to go see. I would actually urge you to see it because it is more human in 89 minutes than any, you know, 149 minutes of The Lone Ranger. But the thing is, these little movies, where are they going? We're seeing them in the, you know, art house theaters, and increasingly they're popping up on demand, often on the day they appear in theaters. So there is this alternate stream, but you have to sort of be aware of them and go out and look for them.
Ty Burr, you're great, author of Gods Like Us, film critic for the Boston Globe. Ty, thank you very much for being with us. Behind us right here, the sound of combat inside the White House from the new action film White House Down, starring Jamie Foxx and Channing Tatum. Ah, the sounds of summer, 2013. Joining us now from Miami is Linda Obst. Her new book is Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. Linda Obst, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Sleepless in Hollywood, of course, you've got a long list of credits to your name. Sleepless in Seattle, Hope Floats, One Fine Day, and right on through. What's going on in Hollywood? What's driving the kind of movies that we're seeing?
Well, what's driving this pure diet of tent poles is the domination of the global market. China is the number two market in the world, and by 2020 it's going to be number one. Russia is huge, which is of course why the movie that Ty was talking about took place in Russia. And when I first came into the business in what I call the old abnormal, the foreign market, the international market, was 20% of profits, and now it's 80% of profits. So it's completely reversed since I came into the business.
80% of profits for Hollywood for the Hollywood film industry overall coming from overseas? Is that what you're...
That's exactly right.
Does that mean 80% of viewers are overseas, or somehow it's just more profitable once they get there? What does that mean?
Both.
Both.
It means 80% of viewers and 80% of dollars. For example, as huge as the China market is, we only get 25% of our profits from the Chinese movies that get released there, and there is a limit on the amount of Chinese films, American films that can be released in China.
Right.
So with the quota and even with the limited profits, it's still huge in the thinking of the American studios.
So what does it mean for the films that we're seeing, that we're going to see, that there's such a huge global market now?
It means that writing, nuance, dialogue is secondary to action. And that's why this huge concentration on tentpoles, on action, because you can't loop so much. That's one thing it means. It means that you're going to be seeing more and more Chinese stars, international stars. It means that most of all, we're dependent on pre-awareness. That is that the international market needs to be aware of the title becomes more important than the movie star.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new Hollywood. Blockbuster or bust, talk of a $50 movie ticket, the impact of the global movie market and global money on the movies that are made, the movies we see, the movies that are not made. Pacific Rim, out next week, $180 million wannabe blockbuster. Legions of alien monsters emerge from a time warp in the Pacific, bent on taking over the planet.
Today, at the edge of our hope, at the end of our time, we have chosen to believe in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Today we face the monsters that are at our door, from Pacific Rim. Out next week, Linda Obst is with us, author of the new book, Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. She's been a film and TV producer, more than 16 movies, Sleepless in Seattle and right on through. Early in her film career, she developed Flashdance and Clue and Contact. Joins us today from Miami. Take us through your sort of theory of your case, Linda. I mean, you say DVD business was floating Hollywood, let them have a little more flexibility. That crashed, and that's driven what?
That's just at the time that the DVD market crashed. The global market started expanding. It was during globalization. They started building huge amounts of theaters in Russia and China. China is building 1,000 theaters a day, and they're all 3D and IMAX theaters. And in fact, 3D and IMAX films are the only films allowed of American films in Russia. And not only is 3D king abroad, but think about marketing for a second. When we open a film in America, we make hundreds of television spots for each market.
Yep.
All over the country. We have one sheets and trailers, trailers being, in fact, the most important factor. And we can modulate how many television spots to take for each city, and then we can track that. If we tried to do that internationally, it would be prohibitively expensive. We actually can't do that. It would cost billions of dollars. So what became the most important factor in opening a movie overseas is the title, is the awareness of the movie, which caused what I called sequelitis. Once a movie opens first in a country abroad, then the second iteration is already known. The third iteration is known even better. Mm-hmm. A great example of this I have in the book is Ice Age, which did well in the U.S. In its first iteration, and in its second iteration did exactly the same in the U.S., but doubled abroad. In its third iteration, it did the same in the U.S. It flattened. It did the exact same amount. And it doubled again.
Build title awareness globally, and you've got your profits, even if it means Ice Age 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or Fast and Furious the same. Where does this go, Linda? At some point, do these overseas profits get plowed back into giving us marvelous films?
Well, it used to be that way. We used to use the DVD cushion to make smaller films. But now that films are so expensive, they seem to get pushed back into more big films. Because if a film costs $200 million to make, it costs some large portion of that to market. So we can't afford the small movies. Well, I think we can if we make one less bad blockbuster. We could break that down into a few good $20 million or even $15 million movies, but the studios just aren't doing that. So it creates what Ty was talking about. I call it tent poles and tadpoles.
Tent poles being the big blockbusters that hold up the whole industry. Tadpoles, what? The indie world.
The indie world. The studios, with the exception of the paranormal series, which is a wild exception to this, which costs like $3 million. But basically, the tiny movies are being starved. There are a few studios that try to make very economically original movies, the one-off, but movies that can't be sequelized. But by and large, the studios are in the business of making franchises, which are movies that can be sequelized and become a business proposition because they create more and more awareness, and therefore each iteration is another is the same business proposition.
Maybe
and the most successful being Fast and Furious, excuse me.
Oh, so I'm sorry. Maybe tadpoles are all it takes. I mean, is that such a problem if you have lower budget films, but, you know, indie films that go after subtle, nuanced themes and subjects? Maybe that's...
Well, they're just being starved. I mean, the crews aren't getting paid. The actors aren't getting paid. If it weren't for actors, we couldn't even make these films because they're working without fees. They're working for scale. And also, they can barely get distribution. It's wonderful that the technology, which, you know, destroyed the DVD industry, is giving us all kinds of new venues and creative new outputs like Netflix and Yahoo, and new distribution is
digital,
being formed
online
every day.
Yeah.
Digital, online. But the producers aren't making any money off of that. So it's a starvation business. And while we get to see these films and one or two of them break into the studios and get picked up for Oscar consideration, that's a tiny, tiny little fraction of the amount of indies that are getting made. So I want the studios to do their job. They're in show business, but there is a show in the business. It's not business. I think the studios should, besides the one entry they make each year for the Oscars, be in the business of creating films. It's an American art form, and you can make money on it. Look at the movies like Black Swan and even Exotic Marigold Hotel made hundreds of millions of dollars last year. There are some of these movies that are big money makers. Last year we saw Silver Linings Playbook break the $100 million mark.
Mm-hmm.
So these movies can make money, but what it takes is gut. And the studios are terrified of gut.
Gut, the guts, the nerve to actually do it.
Read a script. And
yeah, pay attention. Linda Opes wants the studios to do their job. Well, one of their jobs, a big one lately, is just blockbusters, Fast and sequels above all in a global market, she says. Fast and Furious 6 out in May. Here we go. Dom, played by Vin Diesel.
I'm going to need everything. All the info you got.
You'll get it when the team gets it.
No team. This is going to have to be me alone.
It's not that simple. The crew we're after, they hit like thunder and disappear like smoke. You going alone, you won't ever touch them.
Thunder and smoke in Fast and Furious 6. Linda Opes' new book is Sleepless in Hollywood. Joining us as well right now from Culver City, California, is Sharon Waxman, CEO, editor-in-chief of TheWrap.com, which covers Hollywood and the movie business, has a lot of throw weight in Hollywood these days. She also runs a very well-known conference in Hollywood called The Grill, brings together innovators and industry leaders in the entertainment industry to talk about future trends. Sharon Waxman, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Linda Opes is not too optimistic about where we're headed with the global movie market that's opening up here and gobbling up blockbusters and sequels. She sees it as a kind of almost mortal threat to what Hollywood has done and will do. What do you see, Sharon?
Well, you know, I don't disagree with her analysis, but I would step back and look at it from one layer back, which is to say that the movie studios and the movie business really is in crisis, in my opinion, because it's in transition. So what propped up the movie business for a little bit more than a decade was the DVD business, yeah. Right? We used to rent them, and then from the moment that Hollywood figured out how to make us all buy DVDs instead mm-hmm. of renting them, it just became this massive ocean of cash that floated the movie business. And that couldn't last, really, if you thought about it, because at the end of the day, we're all going to buy our libraries, which we all did, and then Hollywood's trying to figure out how are we going to get you all to buy it in high def, and then how are we going to get you all to buy the same DVDs in Blu-ray. Well, by the time Blu-ray came along, the whole thing was already being massively disrupted by the internet. So, you know, the DVD, addiction was never going to last forever.
Sure.
So now, right now, you've got a business that's just in contraction generally. It's adjusting. So with the arrival of companies like Netflix, which was at first looked at, which by the way, the movie studios should have invented themselves, right? They should have figured out. Yeah, exactly. Right. They should have embraced that in the same way that newspapers failed to see the digital threat coming along and just until it was too late for newspapers to figure out how to change their business model. And in the same way that the music business didn't see, the piracy coming and should have embraced or created a Pandora, created Spotify, created all those things themselves.
Easy to say. So, nobody did it.
Right. So now they're just basically figuring out how to survive. And so the way they're surviving is exactly as Linda has described, is by relying on the movies that they know can bring in enough money, which is appealing to the global market, as she says, and relying on franchises. In other words, you now have so many choices as a consumer who can go out. You can do video games. You can chat with your friends on Facebook. Yeah. You can go to the movie theaters, but you might not. So they want to attract you with a title you've already heard of. Of course, you want Hangover. I love that movie. I'm going to go see Hangover 2, which really wasn't very good. Hangover 3 did well.
Forget about it. And yet there is such a role that movies have played in helping us understand life and the world and philosophy and love in our country, you name it. We look at some of these, and it's just not there. Sharon Waxman with TheWrap.com. Linda Obst, author of Sleepless in Hollywood. Please stand by. Lots of callers here on the movie front. Sheldon in Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Sheldon. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Eventually, it's like your last caller said, it's going to go digital. The internet's going to take over. The big screen's going to go the way of drive-in theaters. And so it goes and all that, you know, because it's like, you know, she was saying they should have seen it a long time ago. They actually should have constructed it way back when. But, I mean, I'm almost like 52, and I lived through, you know, the years of the drive-in theaters. You thought they would be around forever.
Yeah.
And now you see skeletons of them. And the big screen movies are going to be the same way. I mean, it's not going to matter how good they reinvent it, how good the movie is, you know, it's going to go digital. The internet's going to end up taking it over.
So people are going to watch on their laptop or in their home theater, Sheldon, and just not go out to see it.
Exactly. I hate to be a stick in the mud.
No, you may be right. I don't know. I mean, Linda, how about it? We had Steven Spielberg, No Small Observer, recently saying, I guess along these lines, maybe fewer theaters and $50 tickets to go to the movies. What about big screen theaters going the way of the drive-in? Can you see that, Linda?
I think there are some audiences that will always want to go out to see a movie. There's something communal about seeing movies.
Absolutely.
I think certainly young people want to go out of their house, leave their parents, mm-hmm. and go hang out together. I think there are some parts, there's some kinds of movies that you want to see with an audience. And those are event movies in some ways. I think everybody wanted to see Inception with an audience, mm-hmm. not in their bedroom. And that's one of the things that recommend really good tentpoles. If it's a zeitgeist event, if it's something that you want to be able to talk about afterwards with all your friends, you're not going to want to see it on your small screen. But there are fantastic home entertainment devices and systems that are going to make home entertainment really wonderful. I think as we get older, we like to stay home. And when we're younger, we like to go out.
I mean, maybe, but I know a lot of young people who are also just, you know, watching on laptops, and that's just, they're just used to that now. Movies are expensive for them already.
It's true, but I think it depends on the movie. Mm-hmm. I think part of the job of the movie industry is to create excitement about movies that you want to see on the first weekend. I think that there are young couples that want to go on dates and leave their house. So I think it's our job to create movies that people want to go out of their house to see. And I think that making the theater experience, the movie theater experience, better, cleaner, more enjoyable, with better food, I think that's part of it.
Sharon, what is Steven Spielberg talking about?
Well, that is happening too, by the way.
Well, I mean, you see that, but you also see high ticket prices. When Spielberg says $50 tickets, what's he talking about, Sharon?
I don't know what he's talking about. I don't know if he's talking. I wasn't at that speech that he gave at USC, but I mean, I don't know if he was talking about he's trying to ring the bell and, you know, wake people up, or is he really saying that going to the movies is just going to become this rarefied experience? Because obviously, going to the movies is meant to be a mass entertainment experience, or the whole thing doesn't work.
But why not? I mean, TV's a mass experience, but it doesn't happen in a theater.
Yes, but as our culture has shown, we both go to the movies and we watch TV, so they shouldn't necessarily be mutually exclusive. And it's not it's mass and it's free, except for those those of us who are paying cable bills, which is almost everybody.
Yeah.
But the thing about the movie experience is, you know, we had you mentioned this conference that we put on. We had a panel at the conference we had on Friday with a group of with the Grill, right, which we did a new one, which was about global film production. It was focused on China, to Linda's point, and it was just amazing to have. We had CEOs who came in from China to talk about the opportunity there and how doing business there is very difficult. And while China, by the way, is the second biggest market, it's still really in its infancy. So if you have a movie like Iron Man 3, which made $125 million, which is a lot of money in China, it's a lot more than most of the other movies that have been successful have been making. It's such a carefully calibrated and political and diplomatic experience to do that, to get past the censors and to have them give you a date that's a good date, that's not going to be cannibalized by another big movie that they stick on the same date, or to not have it open 2 months after it's open all over the world, so it's been pirated. So it's a really delicate dance that executives have to do there to make China work, but the opportunity is so big that, you know, it of course behooves the business to do that. But what I wanted to mention is that there was one of the people we had on a panel of innovators who we'd named as the people who are really changing the business in Hollywood was this guy called Freddie Wong, who's a director who makes these big action movies on YouTube. This guy makes million-dollar budget movies on YouTube.
Wow.
And he has been wooed by the Hollywood studios to come make movies for the system. And he says, so far, I don't really want to do that. I control all my intellectual property. I control the movie I make. I control the business. I control distribution. And then I own it afterwards. So you need to give me a really compelling reason to stop that. This guy has almost a billion views on YouTube. And he's built a business around that.
You cannot
so
get
that's
much
the future.
You can't get much further from the big screen than that, let alone the drive-in. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the new Hollywood. Blockbuster or bust, kind of the theme. Talk of a $50 ticket, the impact of the global movie market and global money as well, financing films on the movies that are made, on the movies we see. One of the few exceptions to the tentpole blockbuster rule this summer is Fruitvale Station. Actor Forrest Whitaker was so impressed by new young director Ryan Coogler that he gave him the money to make the movie, but on a shoestring. It tells the story of the last day of Oscar Grant's life, based on the true story of Oscar Grant, who was shot by a policeman while in handcuffs on the platform of a Bay Area train station in 2008. Here's Michael B. Jordan as Grant and Ariana Neal as Tatiana, his daughter, in the hours before his death.
I'm scared.
Scared of what?
I hear guns outside.
You know what, baby? Those just firecrackers. You're safe inside with your cousin.
What about you, Daddy?
Me? Maybe I'm gonna be fine.
Except he's not. But no timpani drums, no explosions right there in Fruitvale Station. No blockbuster sound there with Michael B. Jordan and Ariana Neal. Linda Opes joins us today from Miami. Her new book is Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. Sharon Waxman is here. She is editor-in-chief of The Wrap .com and runs the Hollywood conference The Grill, joins us from Culver City, California. It's great to have both of you with us. Patsy's calling from Savannah, Georgia. Patsy, you're on the air. What do you think about all this?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I'm glad I got through because I've been dying, and Linda Obes to ask this question, too. I have her book on hold at the public library, but my husband and I are 62, and we used to go see every movie, the first show on Friday, when we were in our late 20s or early 30s, we sat through Star Wars twice, the original movie. We couldn't believe what we were looking at, and we just didn't even get out of our seats. We'd never done that before, but now it's really nothing. I mean, we talked about going to see The Lone Ranger because we loved Johnny Depp in the Pirates movies, and my husband's a college professor of photography, and I love movies, but TV is so good this summer. The writing, Spielberg is making this little TV movie, I call it, with aliens and people on horseback, and it's better than that movie they made sort of that way. But, you know, is the great writing, stories, casting on TV going to help Hollywood see the light?
Patsy, let us pick it up. I mean, we've got a lot of people writing this. Linda, Sharon, Andy writes online. He says, you know, the best writing, the most meaningful content these days is moving toward the surging television and electronic media market. Linda, how about it? Maybe that's just where it goes.
Well, that's exactly right. That's a very astute realization. After the writer's strike and concurrent with this blockbuster machine at the studios, where there's really about five specialists in blockbuster writing and tentpole writing, and it's written by a few people and then sort of in a factory assembly line in many ways, you know, adding the jokes to the pretty standard stories in the tentpole machine. The best writers whose deals were not picked up by the studio after the writer's strike started realizing what freedom existed in television. It began, of course, with The Sopranos on HBO.
Yeah.
And then Showtime picked up after HBO and started doing some extraordinary writing. We see it on Homeland. We see it on many shows on cable. And then there was what I wrote in the book. I call the chapter The Diaspora. All the really good writers started saying, what am I knocking my head against the wall for in features? I want to write for TV. In television, the writers are the bosses. They hire the actors. They run the writer's room. They hire everybody. And they have the freedom to pretty much create their own stories. And the other wonderful thing about television is that the story doesn't have to resolve in the third act. It's character-driven.
Right.
So the characters drive the story. And that was a great relief to me when I moved to television because for once the plot wasn't driving the situation. Mm-hmm. The characters were driving the situation.
You know, Sharon, if I may, does that make the difference, just the setting then? Is it possible the best drama that we're going to see on a screen will be small screen, and the only thing you won't have is that great big hall, that great big screen, and the smell of movie theater popcorn?
Well, I don't think there's any question that the best quality entertainment and the most of it right now is on television. It's on premium cable. It's on AMC. It's on FX. Mad Men, The Killing, Breaking Bad. Everything on friggin' HBO, Showtime. It's really and this puts, by the way, the broadcast networks to shame. Like, what are these guys doing? Why can't they put out the quality that cable seems to be putting out night after night? Now,
well,
granted,
there's
they don't
a
have
reason
to do
for
it.
That, Sharon, of course,
yeah.
Because they're,
of course, yeah.
They're, they have broadcast constraints. But they are affected by cable. They are wanting to have more subversive leads. They are changing their stories as a result. There is a slow effect on broadcast of cable.
But what do we lose not lose?
Yeah, we can hope that we can improve the quality. But to the point of – sorry, what I just want to say is that overall – you have writers and directors moving very fluidly between movies and television right now, and you have a lot of them saying that they prefer to work in television for the reasons that Linda just said, for the creative freedom, for the being able to work over a 10 series. And now we have another wrinkle in this, which is that the internet streaming services are also going into original programming,
sure.
And they are putting their money where their mouth is. And Netflix is now doing series like House of Cards with the likes of Kevin Spacey and David Fincher. These are the best in the business.
So what do we lose or not lose then if drama goes to the smaller screen? We don't have the big screen doing as much quality work. Do we really lose something there or not, Linda?
Well, it's interesting. I had a meeting with a guy who had a lot of money, and he said in the feature business during this fallow period, during the terrible 2008-09 period, and he said to me, "We have one rule: no drama." And I couldn't believe it.
Meaning, not that they won't be dramatic, but they won't be drama in the nuanced, sophisticated, old school sense.
No, literally, no drama.
I don't even know what that means. In that,
he put a slash through the word drama. What? You can have action. You can
meaning
have
comedies,
horror.
Action.
I see. Okay,
yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Comedy,
no
action.
Drama. And I thought, I have to do television. Do you know I can still do drama? What this means really is it's becoming one big mush pot. Do you know? We're going to, and it's like what the first caller said, we're going to have a screen at home, and it's going to have everything. It's going to have television. It's going to have Netflix. It's going to have a whole series of venues that are going to be showing a range of entertainment. The best of independent film, the best of cable, the best of network, the best of original programming from all of these new platforms that Sharon was indicating. And it's going to be called entertainment. And we're just going to all figure out what buttons to press to watch the best shows that are our taste.
Entertainment, never mind movies. What do you say, Sharon?
I wanted to point out one other thing, which is there is this explosion going on right now, even as we're watching with dismay the really sort of mono diet that we've got at the movie theater. There is this other phenomenon going on in online video that is going to absolutely change the range of cultural experience that we're able to have as consumers, as a society. And you're not seeing the results of it yet, but I can tell you, as somebody who covers the business every day, the amount of talent and energy and ideas that's going into short form video, that some of it's on YouTube, some of it's in other places, and studios like Maker Studios, which has just had this huge investment, and it's this massive here in Culver City, has this massive, like a studio, like a Warner Brothers that they've made, where they're creating talent, where they're creating content, all day long. It's just, you're just starting to see the sprouts of this. Give it 2 or 3 years, and there's going to be another entire category of entertainment.
Where will it be screened? In movie theaters or somewhere else?
No, not on movie theaters. I mean, to your question of whether it's a loss that the movies have been, reduced to these different, very sort of narrow categories, I do agree. It is a loss that it is one of the great American art forms, maybe the greatest American art form. And we do lose something when that goes away. I don't believe it'll go away, but I think that it just becomes more reduced in the landscape of things that we get to do. And so that I do think that would be a shame. And no, I don't think we're going to see Freddie Wong's movies on the big screen, the ones that he's making for YouTube. But at the same time, change, you know, it may not be better, it'll just be different. I mean, that's the evolution of our society, and we have to evolve with it.
Boy, evolution can be very dramatic. Herbert calling from Boston is on the air. Hi, Herbert. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking me.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with what I'm hearing here with the tendency of where the global industry goes and where Hollywood really lags. I mean, I'm acting a lot in independent films and do some film music for it. And what I can see is on the script basis is even those new hopeful directors that are coming out of film schools, the only thing that they think they can make it is when they do scripts that have a lot of violence in it, darkness, negativism, zombies, all those type of things. And then you just look at the big screen and you see all those big movies that pour a lot of $1 million into technical effects and total amounts of destruction and things like that nature. And I'm just asking, what about the other genre like romance, you know? Seriously, because, I mean, you know, my wife...
No, I just almost burst into tears.
Well, but it's a good question.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, why not? Violence, yes, you could call it sadly a universal, but, you know, Herbert raises, romance is also a universal, and surely there's a global language there as well. Why not? Just as a hypothetical, why shouldn't that be the subject of the tentpole blockbuster, Linda?
Well, you know, that's what I did most of my career, and that's what I couldn't get made when I started to write this book. You'd think that romance was poison as opposed to violence. Partly, you know, women like violence, like romance, do you know? And they're very dubious about women going to movies, even though obviously this weekend they championed The Heat and they took a poll and 88% of the audience said they wanted more women's pictures. I made a movie called Sleepless in Seattle that sure. Men keep telling me they liked more than women. It was a man's picture, men keep telling me. Mm. But one of the problems with romance is that it's not sequelizable. Do you know, people don't want to know what happened to the couple after they got together.
Well, I mean, Before Midnight worked it out, but I guess that's the rare exception.
Yes, that's the rare
exception.
7 years
between.
Yeah. I'm going to have to figure out how to do that on a larger scale.
Right.
So I think, for one thing, marketers and studios believe that women will go to a man's movie if it's good, but men won't go to a woman's movie if it's good.
Yeah.
No matter what. And I think many people have proven that false. I think this is one of the biggest questions in the movie business right now. Women are clamoring for movies that speak to the higher part of ourselves, not to what Carl Sagan used to call the R complex, the reptilian complex, the part that responds to fear and anger. I think even the global audience, you know, they mate.
Yes.
They have children.
Everybody does it. There's no question about it. Of course, you mentioned The Heat with Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock there. I mean, here's Steven Soderbergh with his famous, you know, critique, just a few weeks ago now, saying that, you know, he's getting out of it. Steven Soderbergh, great director, saying, cinema as I define it and as something that inspired me is under assault by the studios. He called the big studios something like Detroit before the bailout, saying that the blockbuster is a trajectory that I think is difficult to reverse. But, you know, Sharon, here's Derek who writes to us, who says, in the hands of the right director, Guillermo del Toro with Pacific Rim, I don't know, these can be great sci-fi films. Blockbusters don't have to be bad. Do you buy that?
Yeah, I think blockbusters can be great. I just don't think any of us want to only see that. It's just
exactly.
It gets to be – it's so cacophonous. It's like it's so overwhelming. Last summer was just as bad. It was sequel after sequel. It was Thor and Captain America, and it's the same this summer. There's one element I wanted to bring up that I think plays significantly in all of this, which is the decline of the movie star. You know, you don't have movie stars like we had 10 years ago, when Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan did Sleepless in Seattle, everybody would get up off of their duffs to go see them in the movie, and then the movie's great. So you'll watch it again and again, as I'm sure most of us.
But who says we don't? I mean, Johnny Depp is supposed to pull him out for Lone Ranger, right?
Well, Johnny Depp is a movie star, but there's, you know, you can count him on one hand. And the number of women movie stars, you can count on a couple of fingers. And when I say movie stars, I mean people who will actually get fans to get up and go to the theater and spend their money to buy a ticket. So Nicole Kidman is a movie star, but she's not somebody who we'd call box office, right? You don't get up and go see a movie because Nicole Kidman is in it. And so when they're looking desperately, Hollywood, for people like Channing Tatum, who was in the movie mm-hmm. that bombed this weekend, White House Down, or Jamie Foxx, to see if they can become the Tom Cruise of their generation. This guy, by the way, who's in Fruitvale, Michael B. Jordan,
mm-hmm.
keep your eye on him. He's super charismatic. He's great in this movie.
But Sharon,
think
of Melissa McCarthy, okay? She was a mm-hmm. television nobody before Bridesmaids, which had four unknown women in it. And if it weren't for Judd Apatow, that movie would never have gotten made. Then the movie did huge business, which was completely unpredicted and counter-prognosticated in America, and then did huge business abroad. And now she's a movie star and a female movie star, and people go to her movies. So you can invent female movie stars if you just make female movies.
Make the effort. Maybe it will be Chinese movie stars to bring them. I see
it will.
Bing Bing Li in Transformers next year.
Exactly.
Oh, boy. New market, new day, new age, and a very uncertain path for the Hollywood film industry as we've known it. I guess already gone, morphing a mile a minute here. Linda Obst writes about all of it in Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. Linda, wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you for joining us. Thank you so much, Tom. And Sharon Waxman, editor-in-chief at TheWrap.com from Culver City, California today. Sharon, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.